The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack from the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this magazine for the last 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. It's time now to return to the May 2018 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. We've been reading 20 stories from North Carolina's borders, Knott's Island to Clingman's Dome. We've covered the west and central part of the states, and now we start on the east, under the article heading, The Lines That Shape Us. We begin with Remote or Not, K-N-O-T-T, Knott's Island. Sometimes people end up at the Knott's Island market with a single question, where am I? Usually they're serious. Beverly Gilliam, who owns the market, remembers how one of those conversations went. You're in North Carolina, she said. No, I am not, the person replied. Yes, you are. Then Gilliam showed them a map. Seriously, she said. The next question, how do I get off the island? Even people who do know when they're going are a little worried. You see a lot of people stop on the causeway, turn around, and go back north, Gilliam says, because if it's your first time across the causeway, it goes forever. The causeway, which takes you into Virginia, is the only way to drive into the island. You can also get there via a 45-minute ferry ride from Currituck. If you're coming from anywhere else in North Carolina, this place feels remote. But the people who live here insist that it's not a remote place at all. It used to be, Gilliam admits. Knott's Island sits in the northeast corner of the state, in a sound between the tip-top of the Outer Banks and the mainland. It is tucked up against the Virginia border, and a handful of houses on a peninsula that stick out off the north side are technically in Virginia. A Virginia Beach garbage truck drives out there once a week. The rest of the residents have to haul their own trash to the dump. The Knott's Island Market is the only gas station. There is one bar and restaurant. There is only one school, Knott's Island Elementary. When kids get to middle school age, they have to ride a school bus to the mainland, either on the ferry or the long way through Virginia and back into North Carolina again. It is a long ride, although not the longest in Currituck County. Some students on the northern end of the Outer Banks spend 6 hours a day riding back and forth between Corolla and Currituck. Knott's Island feels remote, and yet everyone insists that it's not. Maybe it's because the border makes us overlook something. And nearly everybody here does their business in Virginia Beach or Chesapeake. Knott's Island is, after all, a Virginia bedroom community. Want to go to the supermarket? It's usually a 30-minute drive. But doing things in North Carolina takes longer. A trip to the DMV to renew your driver's license takes about an hour one way. Picking up a student from school is a much tougher proposition. If you ask the guys who play dominoes every morning at the market, a tradition going back decades, they'll tell you, we're not Virginians. We're North Carolinians. Forget the fact that Knott's Island used to have a Virginia area code. Forget that contacting the law over on the mainland used to require a long-distance call. Forget the fact that some residents have a Norfolk accent. Hint, it sounds slightly Canadian. You're gonna make somebody mad now, was the response to a question about feeling more Virginian than North Carolinian. The issue here for the rest of us is a trick of the eye. The border puts Knott's Island, population 2,126, up in the corner of North Carolina, far away from the state's major cities. The ferry makes it seem hard to find. The causeway leads out of state. Most people, it seems, grew up here or came to be left alone. But here, the border is invisible to most people. That's what happens when you live close to it. Sure, there are little quirks in, say, gas prices and sales taxes. There's a mix of license plates, and there's a bit of in-state loyalty. But Knott's Island is its own thing, a quiet, special place. And if you really want to know what state it's in, just ask. You'll probably be told it's a good one. And now, continuing with the lines that shape us east, the short, remarkable life of Shelley Island. Last year, a longtime reporter for the Virginian Pilot was at the tip of Cape Hatteras to work on a story about new ATV rules when he saw something offshore. "Oh, that?" said the president of the Beach Buggy Association. "That's a new island, just formed. One of our members' grandson calls it Shelley Island on account of all the shells." The reporter, Jeff Hampton, wrote a story about the island for the June 21st edition of the newspaper. And then everybody freaked out. Park rangers and the Outer Banks Visitor Bureau were flooded with calls and questions. Tourists paddled across the narrow channel or simply walked over at low tide. Behind the scenes, National Park Service staff debated whether to call Shelley Island an island, since island implies permanence. They recommended Cape Point Sandbar. "I'd even call it a spit," one staffer said in an email. Those names didn't stick. Islands have come and gone in that area before, thanks to the convergence of two ocean currents. But this one was a mile long and seemed to capture the public's imagination in a way that others hadn't. Good Morning America went live from the island. Of course, the real world has a way of poking holes in the things we hold as true and pure. Several people had to be rescued after getting trapped on the island by the tide, and locals warned about sharks. Then someone found a bomb-shaped piece of World War II-era training ordnance on the island, which had to be blocked off. Then along came a guy from Virginia who filed a quitclaim deed with Dare County and deemed the island his. "I really don't want to own an island," Ken Barlow told the Virginia Pilot. "All I want to do is keep the Park Service from having control." The state claimed that it, not Barlow, owned the island. But it really doesn't matter anymore. By September, the island had connected with Cape Point, which meant that it was no longer an island. It also meant the National Park Service, which owns Cape Point, could claim it. NPS 1, Barlow 0. A few weeks later, Hurricane Maria's wind and storm surge killed off most of what was left of Shelley Island. But for a few short months, it was the hottest new tourist attraction in the Outer Banks. And it captivated dreamers from across the country, including a teenager in Georgia. I was wondering, since the island has no official private owner, if I could claim ownership of the island, and if so, how would I go about doing so? He wrote in an email to Dare County. "If you could please email me back and let me know." Eventually, the teenager was told no, he couldn't have it. But for a brief moment off the coast of North Carolina, land appeared where it hadn't before, and anything was possible. One league across the sea, Atlantic Ocean. Ever stand on the edge of a shoreline and wonder, how far out can I see? The answer is roughly 3 nautical miles, or 1 league, which also, conveniently, is how far North Carolina extends out to sea. Ocean borders were once set at that distance because it corresponded with the range of 18th century artillery. Past that, you're in U.S. territorial waters until you get 12 nautical miles out. So what's the big deal? Shipwrecks, for one, The state of North Carolina can only claim wrecks that lie within its borders. So the Queen Anne's Revenge, just off Beaufort Inlet, is ours. But the USS Monitor, which sits 16 miles south of Cape Hatteras, belongs to the United States. 3 nautical miles is also as far out as state laws apply, and North Carolina can say yes or no to things like oil rigs and wind turbines within that zone as well, which also applies to fishing laws, which fishermen have to obey, but fish do not. You gonna tell a shark what he can do? Sidebar. Both Carolinas inbounds. Brunswick County. The signature hole at Farmstead Golf Links in Calabash is the last one, a 767-yard par 6, which was once the fourth longest golf hole in the world. That in itself would be enough to raise some eyebrows, but the 18th has an added bonus. Golfers tee off in South Carolina and putt in North Carolina. The course itself straddles the border, although the bulk of it, including the clubhouse, is in Brunswick County. You can buy a beer from a beverage cart if you want, but the cart can't cross the state line into South Carolina. The border straddling wasn't part of the original plan. Part of the course sits on what used to be a North Carolina farm owned by the McLamb family since 1939. When W.J. McLamb wanted to get in on the golf craze of the mid-1990s, there was a problem. To have enough space to do what I needed to do, he said, the property I needed was in South Carolina. McLamb bought it up and opened Farmstead in 1998, and today part of 6 holes are in the Palmetto State. You are listening to Our State Magazine and the Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments on our program, call the studios, 919-832-5138. Still in the East, William Byrd's Burn Book, North Carolina-Virginia Border. William Byrd II of Virginia was a surveyor, an author, a statesman, and catty as hell. He was one of the Virginians in charge of physically drawing the border between Virginia and North Carolina, and he wrote a book with a yawn-inducing title, The History of Dividing Line Betwixt Virginia and North Carolina, published in the year of our Lord, 1728. But crack it open for a read, and hoo boy! Byrd calls North Carolinians lazy and says we eat too much barbecue. The inhabitants of N. Carolina devour so much swine's flesh, he writes, that it fills them full of gross humors. By contrast, Byrd was an upstanding, virtuous leader, at least in his public books. In his personal diary, however, he meticulously detailed his extramarital affairs. He also wrote a second book called The Secret History of the Line, intended only for his buddies. It was, spoiler alert, racier. As for his job, Byrd and the team drew, with one tiny exception, a straight line, exactly as they were told, although he sent his underlings to do the dirtiest work. For example, while his surveyors had to draw the line directly through the Great Dismal Swamp, Byrd and the other commissioners went around it. The rest of the Byrd book details plants and animal life, Indians and the like, and reveals that Byrd was genuinely impressed by the beauty of the land. After he completed the survey, he bought 20,000 acres in the Dan River Valley and called them the Land of Eden, a name that persists in Rockingham County to this day. Byrd died in 1744, and his works weren't published until 1841, making him more famous in death than in life, and proving that if you don't have something nice to say, write it down, stash it away, and a century later, we'll all get to read about it. Missed it by that much, Choan River. Next time somebody says that the North Carolina-Virginia border is a straight line, you can loudly, knowingly grimace and patronizingly say, well, actually, William Byrd and his fellow surveyors started on the north end of what was then Currituck Inlet. Update 290 years later, it's no longer an inlet. Headed due west and were supposed to hit the headwaters of the Chowan River. But they ended up half a mile north. So they adjusted by running the line down the middle of the Blackwater River until they got to the beginning of the Chowan. Then they just started heading west again. Which means that in that area, it's possible to stand in North Carolina and look west into Virginia. Weird. Another oddity, thanks to a curve in the border forming Lake Wylie near Charlotte, you can drive north on Highway 49 to get into South Carolina. Or conversely, south to get into North Carolina. And now my head just hurts. The far edges of the state are some 500 miles away from each other. In between are more than 10 million people who call this state home. The population keeps growing, but the state lines won't budge. North Carolina's Constitution decrees that the current borders can never be altered. So even though the personality of our state is ever-changing, the outline will always be the same. The easternmost point, Redonthe. The easternmost point of North Carolina, on land anyway, is not far from the well-preserved Chicamacomico life-saving station on Hatteras Island. And there's a little note here that says several of these stories are available as podcasts, just like ours. To listen, search for Away Message. However, wherever you get your podcast, or visit ourstate.com/borders. That's the end, I guess, of those stories. And now we'll see what's next here. I don't know how long this is. I guess I do know how long it is. Country Comes Home. I think we'll be able to fit it in. Food feeds our memories. Hearty county breakfasts, backyard cookouts, Sunday suppers, regardless of the occasion, every feast, meal, and snack begins the same with a grocery list and a trip to the market. Meat. This is under the heading Market Season, and it says meat. Smith's Red and White in Rocky Mount. It's not that often you see sausage being moved with a shovel. Granted, it's a squeaky, clean shovel, sterile most likely, since the sausage stuffing room and the frigid corridors behind the meat counter at Smith's Red and White grocery store is cold enough to give you double-decker goosebumps. But you have to admit, when there's a heap of ground pig, sage, salt, and red pepper so large you can't move it with a long-handed shovel, or rather ladle, it's a noteworthy pile of sausage. In fact, this hillock of hog I'm gazing at might be the most beloved mountain this side of North Carolina's fall line, because the people who love the fresh sausage at Smith's Red and White love it with a legendary fervor. They love it so much that the grinders at Smith have to grind 10,000 pounds of the stuff a week. A week! Each week during the holiday rush, from the week before Thanksgiving through New Year's Day, upwards of 35,000 pounds of sausage is ground, wrapped, sold, and carted out of tiny dorches up the road from Rocky Mount. Show up the week of Christmas and you'll find a line of sausage fans snaking through the grocery store nearly to the parking lot, kinked up around the aisles like, well, sausage. Like I said, a shovel-worthy pile of ground pigs deserving of marvel. As is this country grocery store, which has grown in size and popularity. Smith's Red and White is tucked off the east side of Interstate 95 at the exit for Dorches and Red Oak in a strip shopping center between a gym and a small bakery. Its siren song is a set of tall storefront letters that proudly spell out Pork Center. Begun in the 1920s, Red and White was a small chain of independently owned rural grocery stores with centralized buying and distribution. The franchise has since faded away, but stores like Smith's and King's Red and White Market in Durham have kept the colorful moniker so beloved by locals. I show up at Smith's Red and White sometimes, twice a week, and without fail, I cruise the meat counter. And by counter, I mean a display of protein fabulousness half a football field long. On the day of my most recent visit, there are no fewer than 23 different cuts of pork for sale. I counted each and every one, from pork tails to neck bones, and everything in between, pork feet and tenderloin, Boston butt and pickney ham, at least four kinds of chops, smack bones, and even souse meat. The store opened in 1954 in a corner of the old Dorch's schoolhouse, the accidental brainchild of Sherwood Smith. "My daddy was a long-distance trucker," says Bruce Smith, 67, president of Smith's Red and White. "He needed to be by a telephone so he wouldn't miss calls for hauling jobs. So we figured if he was going to sit around and wait, he might try to sell a bit of feed and seed and that kind of stuff." Turned out that the folks around Dorch's needed that kind of stuff. And they needed gas and groceries and a place that would slaughter a hog or two. Kept growing and kept growing, Miss Smith says, grinning. Today, the 20,000-square-foot store is at least the sixth iteration, built on the same patch of farmland that housed the original. And the third generation is on the clock. Bruce's son, Derek, is the vice president, and you're just as likely to find him cutting beef as cutting checks. Or spare ribs. Or pork steak. A sister restaurant located next door, itself worthy of a long drive for breakfast or lunch, helps keep demand high. The list of down-home dishes includes the entire southern food pyramid: chicken salad, pimento cheese, collard greens, rutabagas, meatloaf, meatballs and country ham, plus cakes and pies that fill an old-timey round case. Out of sight, behind the butcher shop and deli counters, the stoves and ovens simmer nearly constantly. Smith's Red and White cooks 800 pounds of barbecue each week, along with chicken pastry and Brunswick stew. "And just one of those big kettles over there," Smith says, pointing to a trio of gleaming stainless steel urns, "can cook 300 pounds of chitlins. Sometimes we'll cook 1,000 pounds of chitlins in a day." I whistle. "That's a lot of chitlins," I say. "That's half a ton of chitlins." "Oh, yes," Smith says with a trace of a grin. "It certainly is." But it's not just the big numbers that impress here. A place like Smith's Red and White is a cultural crossroads. Its location, just a sweet tater's throw from the interstate, draws folks from regions where you couldn't find a country ham biscuit in a month of Sundays. Folks from north, west, and even the Far East show up in Dorch's with an open mouth, and three generations of Smiths hope they leave with an open mind. Such culinary diplomacy is a lot to ask of a pig, but then again, you get your choice of mild or hot. Dry or fresh, country sausage or link sausage. There's a certain egalitarian aspect to Smith's Red and White approach to pork. If you can make it from a hog, wrap it up. Somebody will take it by the shovelful. That was written by T. Edward Nickens, and if you want to visit, Smith's Red and White is at 3635 North Halifax Road in Rocky Mount. They've got a website, smithsredandwhite.com. And now an article about eggs. Massey Creek Farms in Madison. Stars still glittered in the early morning sky as Garland McCollum stood in line at the Greensboro Farmers Curb Market. It was 2:30 a.m., and he had already made the 45-minute drive from his farm in Madison to get a table for Saturday's market. Even so, someone from another farm new to the market was already there. "No matter what time I get up and left for the market, they always beat me," Garland says, laughing. "They were always first in line." That was back in 2008, when Massey Creek Farms made its first appearance at the Curb Market. Now they're considered an annual vendor. No more waiting in line before the rooster crows, and customers flock to their table for pork, lamb, and most of all, eggs. At Massey Creek Farms in Rockingham County, chickens spend most of their lives grazing in the fields out in the open air. All of the animals here are pasture-raised, meaning not only are the chickens happier, but their eggs are healthier, high in vitamins and nutrients, and lower in cholesterol, and tastier, too. New Massey Creek customers get a few eggs for free, but they always come back for more. "We'll give you that first taste, and then you're hooked," Garland says. Since before he could read, Garland was flipping through the pages of Progressive Farmer, dreaming of the day he would be a farmer himself. He grew up spending summers with his grandparents on their farm in Rockingham County, one that has been in the family since 1749. After starting out as a commercial hog farmer in the 80s, Garland made the switch to small-scale independent farming in 2008. "That's all I ever wanted to do," he says. "I always had in my mind that I wanted to work with animals." Now Massey Creek eggs make their way from that same farm into restaurants, grocery stores, and farmers markets from Bermuda Run to Pittsboro, close enough for Garland and his wife Ruby to personally deliver them to the stores and restaurants they supply. "Eggs as fresh as ours," Garland says, "are not your typical grocery store eggs." And because the McCollums are so close to their customers, the eggs are always delivered fresh throughout the Piedmont. Just-legged eggs go from the chicken to store to Western Omelette or Eggs Benedict in just a day. Massey Creek's farm. Eggs can be purchased at Piedmont area stores and at the Greensboro Farmers Curb Market. For more information, you can visit MasseyCreekFarms.com. Almost out of time, so I'll read a couple of the advertisements here. I wanted to flip back a couple of pages because I was thinking about reading that one. This is a big double-page ad. It says, "Celebrating 70 years of service to the community. Our communities feel different because they are. St. Joseph of the Pines, nationally accredited Life Plan communities in Pine Knoll and Belmead, the Coventry Constance Cottage and Mary Manor in the Pines, assisted living, the health center, home care, life pace program for elders, affordable housing, mobile rural health. Mission statement is, well, we don't need to go through that, but if you're interested, you can take a tour of Pine Knoll and Belmead and enjoy a complimentary lunch or an overnight stay. Looks like quite a big building. Looks like about six stories high, all brick. Schedule your visit. You can call 910-246-1023. And here's an ad for Wake Med Heart and Vascular. Your heart, your choice. Heart Care Plus. That's Wake Med, Duke Health. Well, that's about all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I certainly hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at the studios, 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.